Welcome to the MTFN Bizcast, a podcast designed to provide information regarding a variety of legal topics. The attorneys at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols host new episodes every month covering topics that are current and relevant to business owners, professionals, and members of the legal community. Although we cannot provide legal advice that you can rely on in these episodes, we do hope that they will be helpful to you if and when you ever do need to seek professional advice.
Welcome back to the MTFN Bizcast and this month's Up for Review segment, where we talk about what's going on in the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the appellate courts in general. I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
Caleb and I are appellate attorneys here at MTFN, and so we take a special interest in what's going on in the court. Now, this month we have a little bit lighter of a schedule, but we do have a few interesting things going on, including a very interesting original action. Caleb, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so we had one original action that was filed in September and dismissed in December. It was, I think, a record turnaround for an original action petition at the Supreme Court. Now, we've talked a bit already about two original actions that have been filed dealing with redistricting claims for Wisconsin's legislative maps. This was separate from that, although it was a little bit related. So a plaintiff named Elaine Hansen Heisel, I believe is how you pronounce her name, filed this original action against Robin Voss and the Wisconsin State Assembly, seeking to enjoin the Assembly from impeaching Justice Protasiewicz. And if you've been following the news a little bit, you'll know that the Assembly, there's been talk in the Assembly about impeaching Justice Protasiewicz if she does not recuse herself from the two redistricting original action petitions. And that's currently under consideration. She hasn't decided yet whether she's going to recuse on those cases. But the news has been, you know, that the Assembly would consider impeachment if she doesn't recuse. This original action petition sought to tell the Assembly, you may not undertake an impeachment vote because there's not a sufficient basis for impeachment here. And pretty much the court shot this down.
I think that's a fair characterization.
They did not take supplemental briefing, or they did not get a responsive brief, rather. The case was filed on September 11th. It was denied on September 26th. No dissents, no writings.
Yeah, and Caleb, I think it's notable that it was denied on September 26th because that was the court's first scheduled conference. And so essentially what it looks like, unless the court met in an unscheduled conference, that this original action was dismissed at the very first opportunity. And I think this is absolutely the right call here. You know, setting aside, you know, what people may feel about the redistricting actions that have been filed, whether or not Justice Protasiewicz's comments on the campaign trail warrant her recusal, setting all of that to the side, what this petition was asking for was something truly, truly extraordinary.
Crazy.
It is asking, so a deliberative body, the judiciary, in this case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, to tell the Wisconsin State Legislature, you can't impeach us. Or more specifically, you can't impeach one of our members.
Can I say it slightly differently?
Sure.
You can't exercise your constitutional power to impeach.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I don't know of that ever happening or what grounds that would be on. This would be somewhat, to use a different branch and a different maybe political affiliation, this would be like when, you know, back when President Trump was in office, him signing an executive order saying, you can't impeach me.
Yes. And I mean, and to be clear, this is totally detached from the merits of impeachment or recusal or any of that. Just setting the merits of those issues entirely aside, a petition asking the court to enjoin the legislature from using this constitutional power is crazy.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you're absolutely right to emphasize that this has nothing to do with whether or not impeachment is warranted or a good idea or a terrible idea or completely ridiculous. You know, that doesn't matter. You can assume that the threats and talk of impeachment is ridiculous and also look at this petition and say, this is just transparently wrong.
Yes. So I think this got the treatment it deserved, and I am pleased that we will not be spending more time on it.
Yep. So another sort of non-case thing, but that's still notable that I wanted to talk about here is Justice Hagedorn actually published a law review article in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy on recent decisions in Wisconsin addressing kind of the administrative state. And it's always notable when a Supreme Court justice takes the time to author a piece of legal analysis. I believe Justice Dallet did one in the Wisconsin Lawyer last year. Was it?
It wasn't in the Wisconsin Lawyer. I think it was in the Wisconsin Law Review. But yeah, she had one with her clerk last year.
Yeah, and so it's always interesting to go read, you know, some analysis from one of the state's highest, you know, one of the judges in the state's highest court, and you know, it was a well done law review article. It was a sort of short 13-page read, but you're just sort of outlining the state of like where the lines are drawn currently. It certainly wasn't an opinion piece of, you know, taking one side or another in the administrative law debates, but it was interesting to have a justice write on that.
Yeah, it's definitely a descriptive article. He did have a few lines in it that were a bit offered a little bit of commentary on the general state of affairs in the court system. At one point, he said, "Each inch, each repository of power is worth fighting for in the eyes of our battle-hardened activists," which is definitely a fair characterization of the advocacy that we see at the Supreme Court. But yeah, I agree. It was a tight 13-page article. Just described the state of where things are at.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't mean to suggest it was free of commentary. It did have the commentary, and I think one of the other interesting remarks is in the article was how Justice Hagedorn observed that Wisconsin is sort of a microcosm of, I think that's the word to use, right? Yeah, microcosm of America. You know, we have some pretty deep political divides. You don't have a clear majority one side or another, and that's what's kind of fueling these activists to look for every inch, as he said, of ground to sort of seize an advantage. And the administrative state and how active or not active the court is going to be in policing the executive branch is just one of those battles.
And we could see how the next chapter plays out in this already this term with the Amazon logistics case that we've talked about a couple times on this podcast. It's also possible it could crop up in the Catholic Charities case that we've discussed, although it wasn't as front and center in the briefing there. But I think we may see the next chapter in this admin law story before too long.
Agreed.
All right. What other court news do we have? Well, one thing I've been watching is I'm still waiting for the November calendar to come out.
Yeah. As of recording, we don't have a November oral argument calendar.
I checked on my way over here and we don't have one. It is, what's the date today? September 29th. So normally these come a month and a half, 2 months ahead of time, I think. Now, there's just not many cases at the court, so maybe that's why. And they only have one potential date on their administrative calendar for which they could schedule our argument, so maybe they just won't have argument in November. But I'm also really curious to see the calendar because you'll recall earlier in the term, there was a majority of the court voted to establish a Supreme Court Administrative Committee. Featuring the Chief Justice and two other justices. And the Chief Justice was opposed to that committee because, in her view, it was unconstitutional because these administrative powers are entrusted to the Chief Justice. One of the powers that was given to the Administrative Committee was the power to set the oral argument calendar. So one thing I'm watching is, when we get the oral argument calendar, are we going to get a picture of whether it's coming from the Chief Justice individually or from this administrative committee? And is it possible that the tension between the two is why we haven't seen it yet?
Yeah, and just like it's kind of a high-level reminder to the non-lawyers who may be listening here. Essentially, the Chief Justice traditionally has handled most of the scheduling things, a lot of just the administrative responsibilities of the court, one of which is setting the calendar. And you know, the Chief Justice is a conservative, and you have essentially the court's liberal majority then created an administrative committee to take over a lot of those responsibilities. And the tension between those two sort of has played out, those two factions has played out a little bit, even so far in the media, as people may be aware. And so there's always the question in my mind about whether or not the delay in the calendar has something to do with that. But, you know, we have no way of knowing that.
Yeah, and that's really, that last bit's the caveat we have to add. It could just be that they're deciding not to schedule cases.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it earlier, but overall cases being filed and taken are down significantly. Yeah. And it could just be that there's just there aren't any cases to hear. So that's the other component there. Who knows? But it is noteworthy that there isn't a calendar as of recording.
All right, James, should we move into the up for review segment of the show?
Absolutely, Caleb.
All right, so we just have one civil case. The court only has two cases all month. One of them is a civil case, so we're going to focus on that one. And it's this case called Andrade v. City of Milwaukee Board of Fire and Police Commissioners. And this case, there were a lot of issues at the Court of Appeals. It's down to one issue at the Supreme Court, but it's an interesting case about the process due public employees before they're terminated. So this case stems from the discharge of Officer Andrade, who, and I apologize if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, but he was present for the arrest of then Bucks player Sterling Brown several years ago. I can't recall exactly when that happened, but it made the news. And after that arrest, Sterling Brown filed a civil lawsuit against the Milwaukee Police Department. And as part of that lawsuit, he included a number of Facebook posts that this officer Andrade had made that were racist and otherwise inappropriate. And once the department got wind of those Facebook posts, it undertook an internal review, analyzed it. There's a number of steps you have to go through that we're going to talk about a little bit more here when you're going to discipline or terminate a public employee. And they notified him that these Facebook posts were the basis for potential discipline to him. So the internal review division finishes its review, and then the chief of police is the one who ultimately makes the decision. And the chief of police here decided to discharge Officer Andrade, but before he did so, he reached out to the district attorney's office and asked for an opinion about whether Officer Andrade would be able to testify in criminal trials at court. And the reason he was concerned about that is because when a witness testifies, the other side can, and I should say that police officers often testify in court because they have to provide evidence to juries about the facts underlying tickets that they give out or crimes that they make arrests for, police reports for, or searches that they've conducted. So police officers are in court all the time. But when someone testifies as a witness in court, the other side is allowed to attack them and impeach them by raising evidence that the person's not trustworthy. And so the chief of police here asked the district attorney's office if this officer makes an arrest in the future and has to testify, will he be impeached by opposing testimony? Will they use these Facebook posts to undermine his credibility? And the district attorney's office took a look at it and said, yeah, we would not put this guy on the stand anymore because he would be impeached and the jury would not find anything he would say credible. And so the chief of police looks at this, and as he testified later on, if Officer Andrade still would have been able to testify, he would have just imposed a severe discipline on him. However, because the district attorney had said that Officer Andrade would no longer be able to testify, the officer decided, well, we can't keep that guy around. We don't have a use for an officer that can't testify. Therefore, I'm going to discharge him rather than discipline him. And that's where we end up with this case. Officer Andrade challenged the discharge on the grounds that he didn't receive proper notice under a federal case called Cleveland Board of Education v. Loudermill. James, you want to take us into the law a little bit?
Yeah. So the critical case, as you mentioned, is this Loudermill case, going back to an even earlier case, Matthews v. Eldridge, The U.S. Supreme Court determined that tenured government employees have certain due process rights to keep their jobs. The Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution protects your right to keep your job as a tenured government employee. Loudermill talks about the standard, like what is the due what is the process that is due when you want to fire a government employee? And essentially there's, you know, you have to be given, you know, notice of the charge. There's three components here. There's, you have to be given oral or written notice of the charges against you. In this case, it would be notice that, hey, you made these Facebook posts and we think that violates the, you know, the conduct here. The second part is an explanation of the evidence supporting the charges. And then the third part is an opportunity to respond to the charges. And so the issue here is not whether they gave him notice, they did, or whether he had an opportunity to respond. He had an opportunity to respond. The critical issue here is whether or not he was given an explanation of the evidence that supported the charges. And you mentioned earlier, there's this part of the analysis where the chief inquires as to the officer's ability to testify in future cases and then gets an opinion from the district attorney and then concludes, apparently based on his own testimony, this was the deciding factor in firing him. Was, well, because you can't testify anymore, we're going to fire you. And so the basic thrust, to oversimplify extensive and thoughtful briefing, is he thinks that, you know, the officer believes that he should have been informed of the district attorney's opinion and the fact that his ability to testify was the ultimate reason for his discharge. He thinks that's part of the requirement that the government provide an explanation of the evidence that supports the charges.
So basically, it was a violation of due process because part of the rationale behind the chief's decision was not explained to him?
That's correct. And so if it's not explained to you, then you can't provide your defense, even if you're given an opportunity to respond.
And so, okay. So,
and I know I'm simplifying arguments here, but it's kind of what we have to do a lot of the time. One more note is worthy of mention here. My understanding is what the officer did not have notice of was this sidebar with the district attorney. He was generally aware at the time of the hearing that his ability to testify is an issue.
At the time of the hearing, yes. But as I read, as I read the Court of Appeals decision and the briefing here, he was not aware of the impeachment issue or the ability to testify issue at the time notice was given at
yes.
the Internal Affairs Division. And he was also not aware of it when the chief was making his decision. It wasn't until after the chief had already decided to discharge him and they were before the administrative review phase of the case that he was aware of this. So he knew before the hearing. But
That's correct. I felt the need to clarify that because to pull back sort of, you know, part of the reason why you get notice is because you need to be able to respond to it. And he was at least generally aware at the time of the hearing. So he was able to give maybe a general response, but I wanted to note that. And I guess before you kick off with your comments on it, I just wanted to note at a very high level, without looking at the dissent, without looking at any further facts, if somebody had given me that general fact pattern, my initial instincts would be like, well, you got your notice. You were told it was the Facebook post. You got your opportunity. You're probably good to go. You know, there's no due process violation here. But as I'm sure you're going to get into in just a minute, there's certainly arguments in the dissent that give you pause about this being an easy case.
Yeah. And, you know, this is one of those cases that I feel that it's especially important to let the audience know that I by no means have a doctorate in Loudermill or federal due process employment law. I think it would be a stretch to say I even have a GED in the subject. But it does set up some interesting questions, and the tension between the majority and the dissent in the Court of Appeals opinion sets up some great questions. So the majority, I believe, was written by Judge White, although I'm not 100% sure about that. And then the dissent was written by Judge Dugan. And Judge White's majority essentially says, Andrade received notice of the content, of the conduct, rather, his conduct that triggered the discipline slash discharge decision. That was the Facebook posts. And that's all that Loudermill requires. But then Judge Dugan says, no, Loudermill requires, quote, an explanation of the employer's evidence, which means you have to explain not just what the evidence is, but why it matters. And then he kind of also raises this additional argument that the district attorney's office opinion that he wouldn't be allowed to testify is an additional piece of evidence that Andrade had a right to be notified of beforehand, which, I mean, that's at least colorable. I see the logic there, right?
Yeah. And to sort of play this out within the standard, going through all three Loudermill, all three Loudermill requirements. Here, the nature of the charges against him. What are the charges that he violated? And I can't name them off the top of my head. There's certain intra-departmental guidelines that he was accused of violating.
One of which was the social media policy, obviously.
Correct. And then the second, an explanation of the evidence supporting the charges, which would be, well, we say you violated these policies. Well, what's the evidence that you violated them? Well, there's these Facebook posts that you made with objectionable content. And this is clearly the majority takes this view and says that's the explanation of the evidence. And the majority says all of the cascading consequences that might flow from your bad behavior don't have to be explained to you in order to satisfy that second requirement right there. And the fact that you won't be able to testify as a result of you violating the policy, evidenced by the social media posts, isn't the evidence. And the employer doesn't necessarily have to give you a full explanation of all the various consequences prior to firing you. So that's the majority's view. Do you think that's a fair summary?
I think it is. And I'd be interested to, there are comparisons. I think you talked about this a little bit beforehand when we chatted about the case. There are comparisons you can draw to other things that the chief might have considered. For example, what if the chief considered the effect that having this officer on the payroll would have on the reputation of the department in the community? Is that something that the chief could only consider if the officer had gotten notice ahead of time that the chief might consider the effect of this person's employment would the effect that this person's employment would have on the reputation in the community? I mean, I guess I don't know the answer to that because I'm not sure what the Supreme Court has said on it, but.
Yeah, and I should offer the same caveat that I don't have, I'm by no means an employment law, admin law expert on these things. You know, I remember Loudermill and Matthews v. Eldridge from law school, right?
So, James, how significant do you think it is that the chief of police here testified that if Andrade were still able to testify, the chief wouldn't have discharged him? He would have just disciplined him. Does that matter?
I think that's tied up with the actual outcome of the case, and that is kind of the question here. I side with the majority here in the Court of Appeals, I think. But that's just my understanding of how due process works. I mean, he got notice of the charges, the evidence was the Facebook post, and this is a collateral decision a collateral consideration that went into the decision to fire him. Now, it was determinative. In here, but I just reading the standard, I don't know that I buy the dissent's argument that this is part of the evidence that has to be explained, because your example earlier of, you know, the other subjective considerations that the chief might have taken into account in firing him, you know, do you have to explain your decision prior to making your decision is kind of how that sounds like. The chief is presented with the evidence, all these Facebook posts, and now there's a review from Internal Affairs, and the chief has to make a decision. And, you know, I guess the counter argument to sort of push back on my own conclusion here is that this consideration about his ability to testify, you know, that's not something that it is evidence, right, of some kind. It's not evidence supporting the charges. It's evidence supporting the chief's decision to terminate. And I guess the question is, does Loudermill's second requirement require you to disclose, to explain all evidence, including that which you rely on in your selection of remedy?
You know, part of the struggle here, I think, is we're reading Loudermill a bit like a statute.
Yeah.
And we're trying to figure out, what does explanation of the evidence mean? What do those words mean? And I'm not sure that's the right way to be thinking about this case, because so the Judge Dugan's approach in the dissent, you know, you say, you know, you look at, if this person's going to testify in an administrative review committee, testimony is evidence. Therefore, if that testimony wasn't described during the notice phase, then you haven't given notice of all the evidence. You haven't provided an explanation of all the evidence against you. But if we take Loudermill to be a bit more functional in its language, to be an opinion rather than a statutory command, you can see how the court is saying, when we say you have to provide an explanation of the evidence against you, what we mean is that you have to put the employee on notice of the specific conduct that you think warrants their removal. Not that you have to explain all of the reasons why this conduct, all the consequences that make this conduct bad and a basis for termination, right?
Yeah, and that's clearly what the majority thinks. And, you know, Judge Dugan takes a little bit different view, that the evidence is all the evidence that goes into the determination to fire, not just the evidence supporting the charges.
So Judge Dugan notes that the noticed part of the process comes during the Internal Affairs Division's investigation, which takes place before the chief decides whether or not to terminate the officer. What do we do with that, James? Is it okay for the chief? Basically, I mean, the question is it okay for the chief to consider consequences that maybe weren't considered in the Internal Affairs Division's investigation?
Yeah, and I actually think this really brings a couple things into clarity for me. So the way these investigations progress, right? You have, you know, Internal Affairs is the one that conducts the investigation and is the one that provides the notice. So, you know, they can't really provide notice of what everything that might pop into the chief's head, questions he might have about it. But what they can do, and what I think Loudermill requires them to do in this case, is Internal Affairs comes up with a conclusion, says, hey, we think you violated these procedures right here, and here's what we think you did to violate them, posting these various things. That seems to be enough right here. Whatever the chief does after the fact, unless he's considering, like, I think you might run into problems if the chief, for instance, did his own investigation of social media posting, found other posts that, you know, also violated departmental guidelines, and then relied on those, because that's, you know, that's essentially additional conduct, additional charges, additional violation that's now he's pulling into it. But that's not what the chief is doing here. What the chief is doing here is Internal Affairs comes to him and says, here's our report, here's what we found. And then he's deciding what to do with that information, right? There's two components. I mean, he either believes what Internal Affairs is saying or he doesn't. You know, obviously, if he doesn't find a violation of policy, there's no need to determine, you know, whether or not to terminate. But really, this just gets into his internal calculus of whether or not to terminate. And he does what most people would do when trying to make a decision. He asks some questions, and he asks questions to somebody who he probably knows in the district attorney. He says, hey, is this going to be a problem? Like, can I just, you know, just discipline this guy and then everything will be fine? Or is this guy like blacklisted on the stand?
So I'm kind of thinking of a test in my head, and I'm not sure quite if it works, but would it be fair to say you have to provide notice of the evidence or an explanation of the evidence that goes to what the violation was? You don't have to provide an explanation of the evidence that factors into the severity of the punishment that is imposed.
I think that gets close to what I was getting at here. And it's just, I think you'd mentioned before, I mean, what if the chief simply just draws on his experience? Like, he knows what these things, what if he's presented with this evidence, he doesn't go talk to the district attorney at all, doesn't do anything like that. He says, man, not only is this guy going to be a black mark on the department and it's going to be a PR nightmare, but I don't know whether or not we're going to be able to put him up on the stand. I know we've had issues with this in the past. I'm all hypothetical, you know. So he just decides to terminate then. It's like, well, is internal affairs supposed to give the officer notice of what might pop into the chief's head? You know, no.
I mean, how could you, right?
What?
How could you, right?
Yeah, that's impossible. And so why would it change just because, okay, now he requests an opinion from the district attorney? You know, whether or not he testifies is not a violation of any of the things that he's accused of violating. It's, you know, as far as I know, you know, that's, it doesn't relate to the, it's not about the charges. It's about, you know, what's in the best interest of the department. Now that we know that these charges are, you know, the evidentiary standard of these charges has been met, right?
Yeah. So I have one follow-up question.
Okay.
How evident do you think it is, based on our analysis, that we are both, I think, kind of Loudermill skeptics?
I don't know. I'd say I'm a Loudermill skeptic. I mean, you know, going back to maybe Matthews v. Eldridge and the whole idea, it's like, do you have a due process right under the Constitution to your public employment to some degree? Now, it's not don't think criminal law, because that's not what the right. That's not what the case law says. I might be skeptical of that in general, but, you know, I just know from my limited experience in administrative law that the process that you're due is not all that high. Like, don't think criminal trial. Don't think, you know, all of this very exhaustive and very detailed protections. You just get some very basic protections, so you can't just get fired for no reason, right?
It's not supposed to be it's not supposed to be like a technocratic process.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, as a non-expert, as one who hasn't been as deep in the case as Judge Dugan, Judge Dugan's dissent kind of reads more like something that would be at home in an analysis of like a Brady violation than, you know, that's where sure. The state yeah. withholds critical evidence, you know, from the defense than something that's at home in an administrative proceeding.
Right. And I mean, just from a practical perspective, you got to think that a department has some discretion when it comes to their personnel decisions, and that you don't necessarily have to have every jot and tittle of your thinking in an internal affairs division investigation before a chief of police makes the final call on how to discipline someone, right?
Yeah, yeah. And one brief caveat. I've mentioned the Matthews v. Eldridge case a couple of times. That's not a government employee case. That was a government benefits case. But I think that was the first one that started introducing these concept sure. of due process to, you know, like in that case, I think it was government benefits. But it's something the government's giving you, whether it's, you know, you're employed by the government or whether it's, you know, I think it was certain welfare and certain state welfare benefits and whether or not those could be terminated basically, you know, without any notice. I forget the details, but the point is you do have this body of case law out there that is importing the U.S. Constitution's due process requirement into these government, either employment or benefit cases.
Well, James, do you have any predictions on how this one comes out?
Well, my prediction is it's going to be an affirm. However, my prediction is not nearly as strong given the dissent as it would have been had somebody just explained this to me in the abstract. The dissent is well put together. Let me put it that way. So I still think it's going to be an affirm. I'd be surprised if it was unanimous. Who knows?
I'm going to go with an affirm as well. And I think it's going to be a pretty convincing affirm.
Okay.
Maybe not unanimous, but I think it'll be close to it. Could be totally wrong. I see how you get to where Judge Dugan did. There's a logic there. But I don't see the court following down that line.
Yeah, I do think it's worth noting one thing here, and that is there are not that many dissents, and I think we've mentioned this before, there are not that many dissents in the Court of Appeals. And so usually when somebody dissents, it does get people's attention because the Court of Appeals tends to have unanimous opinions. And if the Supreme Court reverses, it reverses. But the fact that there's disagreement between, you know, this panel of three lawyers, people are going to I think people are going to take a look at it up on the court. I think the justices are going to carefully look at that. And that's why I'm a little bit, I think it's going to be an affirm. I'm pretty comfortable in that decision, but how close it's going to be, it's hard for me to say at this point.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Want to take us out?
Yeah, that does wrap up our abbreviated October calendar, but thanks again for tuning into Up for Review. We always appreciate people listening to what we have to say, and we most definitely appreciate the work of our producer extraordinaire, Kylie. Thank you.
Thank you, Kylie.
And if you have any questions, comments, or want to reach out, our contact information can be found on our website, mtfn.com. Until next time, I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
Thank you for listening to this MTFN BizCast. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access other podcast episodes, articles, and the contact information for our attorneys. To keep up to date with Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols, you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.